would you react if you discovered something that you created was being used, copied, or referenced without your permission?
The world of content creation can feel like a little bit of a free-for-all sometimes. What are the best ways creators can protect their work from a legal standpoint?
And it's not just about protecting your work. Sometimes it's also about covering your butt.
So consider this court in session as we unpack the legal lessons every creator should learn long before any objections are raised. Hello and welcome to First Frame, where creators come for answers, brought to you by Tell a Story Hive. I'm Jennifer Park.
And I'm Cameron Zinger. And on this season of the podcast, we're diving into the practical and ethical challenges facing Canadian content creators in 2026.
With insights from emerging creators, seasoned pros, and industry insiders, it's our goal to give you clear and actionable advice you can use right now.
Canadian content creators need a podcast to call home. This is it.
It's an aspect of being a content creator that doesn't get nearly as much attention as it should. The legal stuff. All it takes is one wrong move or line of fine print to put your work or yourself at risk.
Legal terms like moral rights or option agreements do sound intimidating. And yes, the law can be complicated, but it doesn't mean that you can bury your head in the sand and just hope everything works out.
It's true. So to help us understand the basics, it's my pleasure to introduce Mark Edwards. He is an entertainment lawyer and managing partner at Edwards Creative Law, which has offices in Ottawa, Toronto, Winnipeg, and Vancouver. Mark, welcome to First Frame.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
We really appreciate you making the time for us today. Maybe to get the ball rolling, though, could you tell our listeners and viewers a little bit about your firm and the kind of work that you do there?
Sure. The firm is called Edwards Creative Law. And it's an entertainment law practice that we started about a dozen years ago. Our practice is focused on film and television, music and games primarily, with some publishing and litigation. And I do primarily film and television work. But unfortunately, there's more litigation these days than there used to be. It might be a sign of the times. So film and television and litigation.
Thank you so much for sharing. Now let's get into the legal chat, and I think it's important to define some terms up front for our listeners. So let's start with one I'm sure everyone has heard before, copyright. So if you could tell us, what exactly is it, when does it kick in, and what's the biggest misconception that creators tend to have about it?
Let me start from the last question first, because I think it kind of sets the framework for this. The biggest misconception is that you have to do something other than create something in order to have copyright in that thing. And particularly people think about registration. So registration is not a requirement of copyright. The essence of copyright is that it is actually not a right, but a set of rights, a bundle of rights to do certain things, to use creative works. You must have an original expression of intellectual creation reduced to a tangible form. So it doesn't apply to an idea, but it does apply to the written version of the idea. It doesn't apply to the concept, but to the script that's written based on that concept, or the sculpture, or the video, or the dance notation. It's the expression of the creative activity captured in a tangible form. That's what gives rise to copyright.
Thank you. I think that's going to be really helpful to creators, because I know, you know, when I grew up, you had an idea and people would say, you have to copyright it, write it down and mail it to yourself. So I guess that's where the part of actually writing it down to have something physical covers the idea.
Right. So what you've really described, it's an interesting. So what you've described is interesting. So writing it down, got it. So that's reducing your idea to a tangible form, mm-hmm. right? So now it's written. And then mailing it to yourself, which is a whole different concept. So what's that about? Why mail it to yourself? It's because you're trying to create a means by which you prove not only that you were the creator of that thing, but also the time which it was created, right?
Right.
So the idea is you've got this stamp
yeah.
on the envelope and you don't open the envelope, but that aspect of it was more about the proof
right.
than it was about the copyright itself.
Perfect. Our creators will appreciate that. since I'm sure there's a lot of them that aren't mailing yes. things to themselves.
I was going to be like, most people, I think, probably do electronic form now, right? So
I'm aging myself there.
But that's actually made proving that you are the creator of this copyright work much easier because, of course, computers put a timestamp on absolutely everything. Yeah. And it means that you don't do one draft. You do 100 drafts and you don't throw any of them away. And so they're all sitting on a drive in your laptop somewhere. And so you've got the, you know, the first time you kind of did a sketch of the idea or of the drawing or the character or the whatever it was, like 3 years ago. And then you've got 200 drafts, each one, you know, building the idea. So proving that the work originated with you is actually much, much easier in the digital age.
So I think that brings me to our next question then. So it's also important then to distinguish between legal rights versus moral rights. Can you break that down a little bit for us?
Sure can, yeah. So legal rights are essentially the economic rights in the work, production, reproduction, publishing, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. So the right to use the work. Those rights can be transferred. You don't have to transfer all of them. You could just transfer a one picture deal, a one book deal, a limited time use, a limited territory use, a limited language use. You can slice and dice it in many, many ways. But essentially, what you're doing is you're transferring or assigning forever or for a limited period of time some of these rights to someone else. On the other hand, moral rights are not legal or economic rights. They're equitable rights. And there are two of them. There's one, the right to be credited. So Mark Edwards, the creator of this thing, this script, or to be anonymous. So I can insist as part of my moral rights under the Copyright Act to remain anonymous. I can also insist, surprisingly, to using a pseudonym. So that's the right of attribution. The second aspect of moral rights is the right to the integrity of the work. And if you've got time for a very quick story, I'll tell you one about...
We love a good story.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Michael Snow, as I recall, I hope I'm getting his name right, did a wonderful sculpture of a flock of geese, half a dozen maybe. And the legal right to that sculpture was purchased by the owners and operators of the Eaton Center in Toronto. And one Christmas, an enterprising employee of the Eaton Center decided it would look great to hang red ribbons around the necks of the geese. But Michael Snow felt it infringed on the artistic integrity of the work. And ultimately, the court agreed. And so that's kind of one of the big cases in Canada. So those are the two aspects of the moral rights. Now, the interesting thing from the creator's perspective, and this is an important distinction, is that you can transfer legal rights, but you can only waive moral rights. Moral rights cannot be given to somebody else. They're personal to the creator, but they can, and in almost all cases in the industry, they are waived. They have to be waived because can you imagine when I was producing animation, we'd have tens of thousands of drawings by a crew of 20, 30, 50, 100 artists. And every one of those drawings needs to be tweaked and refined and stretched and squashed and manipulated in some way. And without the moral rights, we couldn't have done any of that. So in order for the, you know, the creative process to work in film and television, moral rights need to be waived.
Another term that comes up a lot is fair dealing, which in the US can be called fair use. How and when does that come into play?
Far too often. You know, it's kind of the default for laziness, I'm being harsh. It's just that a lack of planning, maybe, or a lack of budget, right? So they say, I really like to use this work. I'd really like to use this music, whatever. I don't have the money. And frankly, I forgot all about it. And I've already done my final edit. And oops, they'll say, well, maybe it's fair dealing. Maybe it's fair use. In most cases, they talk fair use because it's an American term and it's much more widely known. In Canada, it's pretty narrow, though. In Canada, fair dealing is actually defined in the Copyright Act, and it has two elements. The first thing is that it has to be a particular kind of work. So criticism, satire, news programming, parody, private study, education, research. That's the first hoop. It has to be a certain kind of production. And then the second thing is it's a very complex and multifaceted balancing act around the concept of fairness. And so it has to do with what was the character of the use? What was the amount of the use? What were the alternatives available to you to using that? What was the nature of the work? And how did your use affect the value of the thing that you're using in the marketplace? So that kind of impact on the rights holder all goes into the analysis. So it's a much less flexible tool in Canada than it is in the United States, and it's much more limited in its application. So it's not a good starting point for most creators.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of things that creators need to take into consideration that we've already talked about in just a short period of time. So how do creators, though, tend to land themselves in legal trouble? Can you share any examples that you have maybe come across in your work?
I'm looking at a situation right now where the film is in Final Cut and includes a large number of excerpts from another broadcaster's programming. Now, it's old. You know, they assumed that it would be out of copyright. And that assumption is incorrect. And so now you're in this situation where you either have to get a license and you haven't got budget for that license, or you have to take the risk that the broadcaster that owns that footage is going to come after you, or you've got to radically re-edit your film and really do damage to the integrity of the film that you've made. So what's the point of all that? Deal with these issues at the front end, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the number one problem, is that these kinds of issues, and now we're talking clearances, are often dealt with very, very late in the day. So that's a problem.
You've given our creators a lot to consider already, but let's take a quick break for our version of the lightning round.
Yes, it's time to play What's in Your Kit. So Mark, in 30 seconds or less, no pressure, what should creators have in their kits when it comes to legal resources?
AI, number one. Right? I mean, it's a great starting point for a lot of things. Putting complicated concepts into ordinary language and giving you a starting point on many, many things. You need to verify. You need to speak to colleagues who are knowledgeable. You have to be aware that AI will hallucinate, that it will conflate different concepts, that it will occasionally get things wrong. But it's a good starting point.
Excellent.
Now let's get to the main part of this conversation and address the question at the core of the episode. How can creators protect themselves? So Mark, what's the first thing that they should do before they even start pre-production?
Well, the first thing I would say to a creator is that the only foolproof way to protect your idea or your work is not to share it with anybody. But that's very impractical, very difficult to get a film or television product made without the efforts of others. So collaboration is a necessity, obviously. But there's a point there to that, and that is that, number one, sharing it before it's ready to be shared. In other words, the more fully formed your idea, the more realized your concept or your script, and obviously, as we've discussed, it's recorded in some way, the less likely that you're going to encounter difficulties with someone else taking advantage of it. But assuming that you're going to collaborate, which we all do eventually, non-disclosure agreements can be useful. Unfortunately, when you're talking to most of the major players in the industry, the broadcasters, distributors, some of the large producers that you might want to be collaborating with, they won't sign those kinds of agreements. They get too many ideas. There are too many similarities. It's just too great a risk for them. So they're not going to sign your NDAs. So what's it about? It's about choosing the right partners. It's about choosing what to disclose to what type of a partner or audience. In other words, if you're dealing with a very established, reputable broadcaster, and we have a number of them in Canada, they're not in the business of ripping you off. You can freely share your concepts and be relatively certain that it's not going to be abused. That trust is not going to be abused. So you need to know the reputation of the people you are dealing with. You need to deal with people you can trust. And obviously with those who are less well known to you and less well known in the community, share less.
It's good to know. And I was going to say, as a broadcaster and a funder, we kind of need our creators to share their ideas with us. Now, other than NDAs, if you had to pick a few basic legal agreements that every creator should be aware of, what would those be?
The number one agreement that they're going to have to deal with in most cases is an option agreement. And so we may get to that later. I hope we'll have a chance to talk about option agreements. But essentially, they're agreements under which you grant certain rights to a producer, to a broadcaster, distributor to work with your ideas. So that's from the individual's perspective. From the producer's perspective, you know, the truth is in Canada, the number one agreement for producers is a production service agreement. It's sad to say, but about 2/3 of the total production volume in this industry is foreign service location production. So you're often working for a client. Mm-hmm. Typically a U.S. client. So understanding a production services agreement and what to watch out for is very important for many Canadian producers. If you're a producer of your own product, obviously you've got financing agreements, you've got cast and crew agreements, and then you've got the exploitation agreements. So a much obviously broader range for a full production legal package for a producer of proprietary productions.
You touched on option agreements. When do they typically come into play in a project's life cycle? And what do they actually do?
So my favorite agreement, really, I love option agreements. They're Russian dolls. And I don't know if most people realize that, but an option agreement is an agreement within an agreement. And they are foundational. They're typically the first agreement that's entered into between a producer and a creator or a scriptwriter. So here's what they do. The outer agreement is the option. And the option just says this. For a period of time, for an amount of money, usually a very small amount of money, but for a period of time, you can shop this around. You can show it to people to gauge interest, you can develop it, you can try to finance it, so you can work with this exclusively, and there won't be anybody else in the market who's got these rights, so you will have the right to try to get this made. And if you succeed in that, you have a right to produce if you exercise the option, and then the first agreement is at an end, and the second agreement is the rights agreement. So option agreements kind of go two ways. An option to negotiate a rights agreement or an option to enter into the rights agreement that we've already negotiated. And for me, the only way to go is the second. An option agreement should include at least the material terms, the most important terms, of the actual rights agreement that the producer and the creator will enter into if they exercise the option.
Now, I have a question when it comes to maybe agreements or contracts. For creators who might be reviewing them for the first time, let's be honest, they tend to have a lot of legal jargon that may seem a little bit overwhelming. But what are the red flags or clauses that creators should watch out for?
Okay, so... And again, this is going to seem like an absurd answer.
Might be a big question for
you. No, I mean, it's what's the number one thing, the number one red flag is that you and I, so creator and producer, have been talking for weeks, maybe months about the deal, what you're going to do, what I'm going to do, what I'm going to get, what you're going to get. And none of that is in the agreement. Anyway, I can give you hundreds of examples where a creator thinks that they have an understanding and absolutely none of it is in the agreement. They're giving up rights, but they're not getting back what they've been told. So the producer said, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to invest in this. I'm going to do development. We're going to do this, all this. And none of that's actually in the agreement. And all I can say to creators is, if it's not in the agreement, it doesn't happen, right? If it's not in the agreement, forget that you've been told that these things will happen. So that's the number one thing. Does the agreement reflect your conversations, the promises that have been made, the discussions you've had? Number one. Number two, are the rights that you're transferring well matched to what the producer has said they want and need, right? I looked at an option agreement last week. The producer wanted to do a series. The producer took all of the rights. If they exercised the option, they owned it. They took the merchandising rights. They took all the ancillary rights, the theatrical, the book, the et cetera. They owned it. So the discussion is about doing a series. That is what the producer intends to do, but they're taking rights that are far beyond what they need. So that's also a red flag, overreaching.
So to wrap things up, what happens when someone does infringe on a creator's right? Take us through the dispute resolution process.
Okay, so it has a number of aspects. The first thing is, you know, the creator wants to document the infringement. So the infringement is sometimes fleeting, videos taken down, et cetera. So screen grabs, save files, document when, where, why, what the infringement was. Then you have to decide what your objective is. What is it that you want to get out of this? Do you want it taken down? Do you want a royalty or a license for the use of it? Do you want the revenue that this individual is generating, for example, on YouTube, to be redirected to you, which is possible in YouTube? So you have to decide what your objective is. The next step, I would suggest, is to look at the platform on which the infringement took place, and often it is one of the online platforms, and to figure out what remedies are available on the platform. Because the easiest and cheapest way may be to just engage the platform remedies. In the US, they're typically notice and takedown, keeping in mind that you may get pushback, and under the notice and takedown rules, you may have to start a lawsuit to enforce your rights. So it's not without risk. It can go sideways. If you have a way to contact the individual who's infringing on your work, it may be you reach out to them and simply communicate your concern. And in many cases, you can resolve it yourself. If you don't, you have to escalate. So at that point, typically you get a cease and desist letter, which is just a formal way of communicating your seriousness to the infringer. And ultimately, if the infringer ignores you or, you know, blows you off and just refuses to take appropriate steps or to compensate you, you may have to sue.
I really appreciate everything that you've shared with us, Mark. But before we say goodbye, one last question for you. At what point should a creator call in the big guns and actually contact a lawyer or industry organization for backup?
It's a very hard question, you know, because it's as much an economic question as anything else, right? Some of the things that happen early in the process can have long-term negative effects. And yet at the beginning, when you're just developing an idea, there's really no revenue or no real prospect of revenue to pay for resources to avoid that negative consequence. There are certain trigger events. When you're collaborating with someone else, so sharing your idea or your initial creative and seeking their input and collaboration, that is a moment where you need to address the issue of their rights to that work, that contribution. So that's a critical point. When someone is looking to take rights from you, so a license or an option agreement or some other agreement the point at which you're transferring rights, giving up certain rights, I think that's an important time to seek some advice. In terms of the disputes, we've talked about that. If you are in a dispute or a dispute arises about intellectual property that is important to you, I do think it's worth getting an hour's worth of advice, just a consultation with someone who has experience in intellectual property disputes. I think that's important. Those are kind of three examples of the types of situation where I think early intervention or early access to some advice, either from another very experienced colleague or producer or entertainment counsel, is worth doing.
Well, Mark, I definitely know who I'm going to call if I ever have any legal issues. So
you're very kind.
It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And thanks again for being part of First Frame.
Yes, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you both.
Oh boy, Cam, there is a lot to think about when it comes to the law. Creators really need to take a step back right when they're starting a project to think about what aspects they need to consider when it comes to legal aspects, agreements, and things like that before they get too far into a project, which can ultimately cause trouble down the road. And I think it's probably something that most of our creators don't even think about, especially those creators who, you know, maybe started creating content at home and just posting it, but now want to move into a slightly bigger project. What stood out the most to you?
Document, document, document,
yes,
is what I heard loud and clear. So that if something does go awry, you're able to go back and show the timeline or show proof of X, Y, Z, right? So I heard that loud and clear. The timestamps are important. And then I also heard loud and clear to make sure that you are getting advice, that you're talking to other people about these things too, so that you're learning. And that legal advice, going for legal counsel, is important. Make sure that, you know, you have that oversight as well.
That's it for this episode of First Frame, brought to you by Tell a Story Hive. Thanks so much to you, our viewers and listeners, for joining us.
Please hit follow so you don't miss a single thing. And if you'd like to learn more about how Tell a Story Hive can help you along your content creation journey, check out storyhive.com.
Until next time, I'm Jennifer Park.
And I'm Cameron Zinger. That's a wrap.